Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be discussing the first movie directed by Star Trek Discovery creator Alex Kurtzman, People Like Us. So, People Like Us. Now, this is a movie which was written by Kurtzman as well as his longtime writing partner Roberto Orci and Jody Lambert. Kurtzman and Orci, of course, wrote or co-wrote Star Trek 09 and Star Trek Into Darkness and produced those movies as well. And Orci produced Beyond, and Kurtzman is producing and creating and writing the pilot for Disco. And for a while there were rumors that he was actually going to be directing the pilot, although apparently that's not true, or definitely that's not true, because he's off making The Mummy.
Yes.
Which, did you see the trailer for The Mummy?
I saw both versions of the trailer, both with the good sound and the bad sound.
Yeah, what did you think?
It's intriguing. This will seem nitpicky, but I really liked, you know, what happened in the trailer, but I was left with the sinking impression of I would have preferred to have that plane sequence be a surprise in the context of the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it seems like something that, if it catches you off guard, is going to be, it looked really good.
Yeah.
Basically. So there's high praise for it, but I wish it had been, they'd kept it in the box for a little bit longer. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought it looked really cool. You know, there are people who were, you know, someone actually like cut together that trailer with like, you know, Mission Impossible, you know, trailers. And, you know, we're like, this really, really fits really well. You know, it's crazy how well this fits. And, you know, I can definitely see that, but I sort of like that idea of, you know, doing The Mummy like that. You know, I mean, there was like a thing. I remember when the Brendan Fraser one was in development, there was like a whole big thing where, like, you know, they set it in the 30s, you know, which is when the original was made and takes place. And like at one point they had like John Sayles like writing the script, and he said it in the modern day, and they're like, no, you should make it a period piece like the original. And he's like, the original wasn't a period piece. The original took place in the modern day. It was just a long time ago. And so I like the idea that they're kind of doing that here. You know, it's a modern day, you know, take on the material, and that's cool. You know, Tom Cruise, I'm a really big fan of, and one of the things that really impressed me was like the direction. You know, it was very high energy and everything like that, and you know, that kind of got me really excited about this movie. And you know, because of that, you know, it makes sense to take a look at People Like Us and see, you know, the one thing that he directed prior. And People Like Us, directed by Alex Kurtzman, and starring Chris Pine, who of course portrays Captain Kirk in the Kelvin timeline. Would you want to give a synopsis of People Like Us?
Yeah, Chris Pine plays a guy who is something of, for lack of a better term, a huckster. He runs commodities trading, but in sort of it's a corporate barter system, and he lives on commission. Something goes wrong, and he has to try to figure out how to save the deal. And while that's going on, he gets a call that his father has died, and he has to fly home and attend the funeral. He is very reticent to do so. You find out that there's a lot of stuff under the surface that he doesn't want to go back home for. And when he gets home, there is a revelation. I don't think this is too much of a spoiler because it's sort of in the description, but he finds out that he has a half sister he never knew about. And he is given a mission basically from his father by way of a note with some money, saying to go find her and take care of her. And the movie is basically him trying to decide how this fits into his life and how he reconciles his image of his, you know, his life as he has known it, with this new life that he, you know, this person that was never a part of his life but is related to him. That is, you know, I mean, that's the driving focus of the film. And I mean, it has a really stellar cast in it. I mean, just like an amazing cast. I mean, aside from Pine, you know, you have Elizabeth Banks and you have Michelle Pfeiffer.
Olivia Wilde.
Yeah, Olivia Wilde's in it. And, playing his dad's lawyer.
Philip Baker Hall.
Yeah, Philip Baker Hall is in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and
Sydney.
When I saw him, yeah. What did you think of it, Mike?
You know, I liked it. I mean, one of the things which I think is interesting is that apparently it's semi-autobiographical. Like, this is something which happened to him.
Right.
And, you know, that's kind of a crazy story. And, you know, I mean, I guess as a screenwriter, as someone whose job it is to tell stories, it makes sense to draw from personal experiences. And this is a pretty crazy one as far as, you know, all things considered. So it's interesting that it's definitely a departure from what Kurtzman and Orsi have done in the past. You know, their shows and movies tend to be action oriented, you know, kind of like sci-fi in a lot of, you know, ways, or fantasy or whatever, whether it's spies or spaceships or Headless Horseman or Jack of All Trades or whatever it is, you know. I mean there's always like some sort of weird side to their stories, and here this is like very sort of like straightforward, just you know, people like us.
There you go.
So I mean, I think that's kind of an interesting choice for his directorial debut. You know, in a lot of ways it makes sense because it's probably a lot easier to direct than something like The Mummy. But in other ways, it seems strange because it seems like it's kind of outside of his comfort zone in a sense. Although it seems strange to say that. I mean, you know, if you look at, say, Alias, which he was a writer on and a producer on, I mean, everyone would always say, like, that's like Felicity but with spies, you know, and it really kind of is. It's you know, first and foremost a character drama, and she just also happens to be an undercover agent as well, you know. But I thought on the whole it was pretty good. You know, the performances were great. I thought it looked, you know, fantastic. It was shot by Salvatore Totino, who has photographed a lot of, you know, really amazing looking movies. He's worked with people like Ron Howard and you know, everything, and I thought it looked really good, you know, which kind of surprised me. And
why would it surprise you though? I mean, I agree with you that it was for somebody's directorial debut. There are shots where I was actually taken aback because I just thought that everything was, you know, so perfectly balanced about it, from the color to the placement of the actors to, you know, what was on the wall. Like, it just looked terrific. But, you know, I mean, considering that Kurtzman, it may be his first directorial debut, but he has been by the side of somebody like Abrams, you know, on set and everything. I mean, I guess that maybe that rubbed off on him.
I mean, I'm sure it did. You know, I'm sure that he learned a lot from hanging out with, you know, the biggest and best directors in the world, you know, whether it's Abrams or Michael Bay or whoever, you know. I mean, these guys are the best, right? And, you know, if you're working with them, you know, and probably, you know, one of the closest relationships you have with another creator, you know, a writer and a director, I mean, obviously, a lot of that stuff is going to rub off. And the fact that he's been doing it for so long, you know, and on TV as well, where, you know, showrunners take on a much, you know, more active role in terms of the, you know, post-production and whatnot, it makes sense, you know, that he would be good at this job. But I guess just any time there is, like, a first-time director, I don't know, maybe I'm just not being, you know, fair to them, but I always feel like, you know, I'm not, you know, who knows how this is going to turn out, you know? I almost feel like, you know, first-time directors, you know, tend to be a little more timid, you know? They might not go out as far out on a ledge as you would expect a director normally would, because, you know, you want to make sure you don't mess anything up, in a sense. And I mean, I guess to be fair, he did direct an episode of Alias, you know, so it's not like this was his very first thing, but it was pretty close. And
well, I mean, you know, it's his first big budget thing, and I think that you know, I mean I think that speaks to why it's a you know, a character drama as opposed to like a big sci-fi action epic. Like, I think that there's something to be said for the fact that he's, you know, he's getting his feet wet by understanding how to build character relationships, and at the same time how to helm something without worrying about 2,000 effects shots or whether the alien makeup's going to look right. You know, he was figuring out how everything, you know, all the pieces could go together, so that when he goes to the next big thing that does have the effects shots, he can say, okay, I can contextualize how I have to approach these things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, it is weird anytime you hear like a first-time director taking on a movie like, you know, let's say The Mummy or Star Trek, you know, Beyond or whatever. It's like, right. Wait, what? You know?
Yeah.
So it makes sense. Like, even if, you know, his dream was to direct like The Mummy, you know, for him to do something smaller first. And I mean, this being such a personal story, I imagine that, you know, he was very much invested in this particular movie, regardless of the scale, you know? And who knows exactly what his, you know, personal preferences are. You know, maybe he just does, you know, Transformers movies because they pay him tons and tons of money, you know? Maybe this is what he really
wants. I think that's a pretty valid
do.
Reason to make a movie. I mean, honestly, I know that we like to talk about artistic intent and artistic merit, but, you know, I always think of Krusty the Clown. You know, they drove a dump truck full of money up to my house. I'm not made of stone.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true, you know. But, yeah, I was definitely impressed, you know, with this, since it was like a first-time film. You know, I did think that it looked really good. I think the performances that he got out of his actors were really good. And I think it's interesting how a lot of the actors in the movie seem to be people who he's worked with, like as a producer or whatever, like Chris Pine and, you know, Olivia Wilde, who was in Cowboys and Aliens.
Yeah, Cowboys and Aliens.
You know, that kind of thing. I mean, it makes sense that you would get people who you know, people who, you know, you've worked with before and would trust you. And, I mean, I think that he did a really good job. And I think that the movie on the whole was pretty good. I mean, you know, honestly, maybe the writing wasn't as good as the directing, which is kind of surprising.
You know, the thing is, it's funny you mention that, because my impression at the end of it was there was a lot of it that I was engaged for. But I think, and you said, like, you know, he's a first time director. You expect somebody to be maybe a little bit timid. I think that the you know, for lack of a better term, timidity comes through where I could sit there and I could say there's probably an argument that a more seasoned director would have shot the stuff and not fallen in love, because it's a great scene in the beginning with Jon Favreau. Mm-hmm. That scene is gangbusters, fantastic. Love the way, like, the dialogue's crisp, the performances are sharp, all of that stuff. But it's something that I would have cut. I would have said, you know what, I'm kind of in love with this, but I have to get rid of it for the greater whole. And then there's the subplot about the FTC, and I hate to say it, but I probably would have eliminated or at least drastically trimmed down Olivia Wilde's character. Yeah. Even in the editing process, it was such that I think it was pretty clear that you could have even at that point cut her out from, you know, the later part of the movie that she shows up. She's not necessary at that part. And so I think that that's where you see sort of first-time director sort of stuff come through, where he, for whatever reason, left those things in when he probably could look back on it with, you know, more sober eyes and say, this doesn't need to be in here for this to work. This can, you know, be an extra on the DVD or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's an interesting thing. I mean, I didn't have a problem with the stuff at the beginning. And Jon Favreau, by the way, another person who he's worked with, a director, you know, which is someone who he's written for as a director. But I don't know. Like, I see what you're saying. The stuff with the FTC kind of felt manufactured in a sense.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I don't know, like the stuff with his mom and his mom's, you know, illness, that felt really manufactured, you know? And it almost felt like it was there to sort of give this, like, conflict that wasn't necessarily, I don't know, like, wasn't necessarily needed. You know, like, the idea that there's, like, something pulling him away from his sister, you know, and I don't think that was necessary. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of a strange choice that was made, but I don't know. I don't have a solution for it necessarily. You know, I mean, I guess I could see why they were doing it in a sense. I just would have gone, like, mechanically, I can see why they did it.
Yeah.
But I think maybe I wouldn't have made it so incredibly dramatic, because you've already got, like, a really dramatic story, you know? And then to add, like, this guy might be going to jail, you know, I mean, that seems like you're just pulling things in too many different directions.
Sure, it's enough to have him fired as opposed to threatened with jail. So, yeah, so maybe my reaction is more based on the fact that they kept up with it instead of just having him get canned.
Yeah.
Like, if he just gets fired, that's great. That's resolved. It's done. You don't need that to continue through.
Yeah.
And his whole internal conflict, I think, to speak to your point about, you know, his mom getting sick, that's an external thing that doesn't really service his character's internal struggle about whether to pursue a relationship with his sister or not.
It's also, that's like the clunkiest part of the movie to me. Like, you know, you see, like, a thing early on where she's, like, hiding her pastries or whatever.
Chocolate chip cookies. Entenmann's chocolate chip cookies, which are quite delicious, I can attest.
I don't know. Entenmann's doesn't really do anything for me. It seems like a kind of a weird brand.
I'm a manufactured food type of guy. I'll take you through a tour of my childhood as to why at some point.
Yeah, that's fair. But, I mean, like, just the way that, you know, like, she's doing this, and it's almost like it's being played for laughs, you know, and it's, like, done in, like, a weird cutaway, like, no one's paying attention, and the whole time I'm thinking, like, this is supposed to be something, and it doesn't make any sense to me where they're going with this, and when you finally get there, I'm like, well, why did you do that early? It doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know. Mm-hmm. The whole thing just did not work. And, you know, but whatever, that's okay. And I also thought that the ending was a little weird and manufactured too, like, to the point where, like, I kind of got it. And then my wife, like, hit the nail on the head for me in terms of exactly what was going on. And I was like, okay. But at the same time, I kept on thinking, like, the way that it's done, you know, because you got to get it to read on film in this specific way, and that's hard to do. And the way that they chose to do it seemed, like, super amateurish, you know.
Which part are you talking? Are you talking about when the revelation happens? Are you talking about that scene, or are you just talking about the fact that the movie trucks along, and then he shows up at the end, and then it? And then it's over. Like, it goes into this thing, and then it's like, end scene. And it's like, wait, what?
The way the revelation happens felt, you know, sort of manufactured in, like, a Hollywood sense. The problem that I had with it was when we were actually watching the home movies. Mm-hmm. When we see what's on the home movies, like, the home movies themselves, I'm like, this does not work at all. This, like, the portrayal of the, you know, this home movie event does not work at all. You know, it's
So I don't disagree. I think it works if there's another 5 minutes at the end of the film.
I know what you're saying, but what I'm saying is, like, the actual, like, 60 or a super 8 footage, just the way that it was filmed, like, I'm like, okay, they're trying to show that this person is filming this and blah, 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 right? And the way that they did it was like the clunkiest way they could possibly do it.
I agree. I have never in my life ever seen anybody operating any sort of camera have that much of their own face on it or get that confused by its operation.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, I mean, that was, yeah.
Yes, I do. I agree with you. It's enough to know where it came from. You don't need to see those shots in that sequence. I completely agree with you.
Right. Like, he could have just said, like, this was footage that this person shot.
Well, and you already know where the camera that contained the footage was found.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
but aside from that, I mean, there was a lot of stuff in it that I did like. You know, I liked the kid. You know, I thought that he was really good and really well written.
And hats off to a first time director getting a solid performance from a child actor.
Yeah,
and actually, you know, getting a worthwhile performance that didn't annoy you at any stage.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely that's true. And you know, I think that the heart of the story is really good. You know, I mean, like the relationship between the brother and the sister, and the brother and the sister's kid, and everything like that. All of that really works well for me. It was everything external to that main story, which was problematic.
I do want to say, I do want to give a tip of the hat actually to Kurtzman, because his taste in music, first and foremost, a lot of credit for the line, "You can't steal from a record store. That's like kicking a dead man." I thought that was a great line.
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
When he went through his list of music you have to listen to, Alex Kurtzman has some great taste in music. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that.
Yeah, I didn't know who half of those bands were.
Oh,
honestly.
Come on, Mike. Do me a favor. Go back and get... you know what? I'll write them down for you, and I want you to listen to the albums that he points out.
Listen to them in that order, just like he tells the kid to?
No, whatever order you prefer.
Okay.
I'll give you a little more leeway than he did.
Okay. All right. That's fair. That's fair.
Pretty some solid albums that he recommends, for sure.
Yeah. I think I've heard one or two of them from what I remember, but there's definitely somewhere I'm like, I've never heard of that group ever.
Yeah, Television isn't really
Television.
A
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're very good. Marquee Moon is a great album.
Is it? Okay. I'll take your word for it.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's weird. It's weird because, like, you would think that the hard part would be that main story, you know, and then integrating the other stuff, you know, would just kind of like be second nature because you're making that stuff up, but that other stuff is the stuff that doesn't work as well, which is surprising. But you know, what can you do? And there was also like a weird thing where, like, I felt like, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, we watch so many movies, I think that we sort of get a sense of when a movie's ending, you know, and you're like, okay, there's like two scenes left in this movie and then we're going to be out of here, and that's great. Like, I had that impression. Like, I was watching it with my wife, and you know, I felt like this is wrapping up. And my wife's like, "How much longer is in this movie?" And I'm thinking, like, it's got to be 5-10 minutes tops. And like, I look at the counter, and it says that there's 26 minutes left in the movie. And I'm like, "Wait, what? What's going on here?" You know? And I mean, nothing. You know, about the ending really did. You know, I don't know. There was a couple extra steps that I wasn't anticipating, but I mean, I felt like they were justified in taking those steps. It was just really weird structurally how there was like almost like an extra act tacked on to the end of it. You know?
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
I do want to say too, you know, because you mentioned the performances. It was, okay, first and foremost, I think Elizabeth Banks is a terrific actress. But to see her in something with a lot more dramatic than comic weight was like a breath of fresh air. It was nice to see her go down that road. And also, it's so easy when an actor gets attached to like a big franchise like Star Trek. You know, they either get typecast or you find out that they can't really succeed outside. You know, there's a reason they get typecast. But Pine is such a good actor. And I think that the scene that really stuck with me was when he went into his dad's, you know, little cave, for lack of a better term, and just started drinking and was going through the grief and the pain of an unresolved relationship. And like it, that was a very resonant scene. And I think that Pine did such a great job of bringing it to life that, you know, I mean, like, just very commendable. I hope that in both the big budget stuff and anything else that he does, that he continues to get opportunities to act like this.
Yeah.
Not, you know, not play this character, but to really demonstrate the range of talent that he has.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's true. I mean, that specific scene that you're talking about was really good, and, you know, it's a bit showy, but I thought that the editing in it was really solid, too. I thought the editing in this movie on the whole was really good, which was another thing that kind of surprised me, although I guess it shouldn't, since he's been in enough editing rooms, you know, on the television side of things. But the movie was edited by Robert Layton, who's Rob Reiner's editor. You know, he edited everything from A Few Good Men to Princess Bride, you know, everything, American President, all that stuff. So, you know, he got some top-tier talent behind the scenes to work on this. But what you're saying about Chris Pine, I think, you know, totally makes sense. And, you know, I would definitely recommend, you know, checking out Hell or High Water, which we talked about on an earlier episode of this show.
Yeah, I wasn't there for that one.
Yeah, but you should still check out Hell or High Water. I mean, in addition to, you know, being sort of a pseudo sequel to Sicario or whatever, it has some really great performances by everyone, but, you know, Chris Pine in particular, you know, who's kind of the lead in that movie.
Excellent.
Or one of the leads in that movie. He's really good, for sure, you know. And, you know, Elizabeth Banks, you know, I totally agree with you. You know, she does do some dramatic stuff on occasion, you know, even if it's like Hunger Games, you know, which is kind of dramatic light in a sense.
but
she's kind
her
of
her role
relief.
In that is comic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, she is definitely a really good actress and a director herself, too, you know.
Yes, although sadly won't be directing Pitch Perfect 3
but
everybody's chagrin.
But she is going to be directing the new Charlie's Angels movie.
I'm on board for that.
I'm totally on board for that. I can't wait.
Yes, that I'm on board for, and I dread the day that my wife drags me to go see Pitch Perfect 3. That's going to be a tough day in my life.
Yeah. But, you know, at least we have Charlie's Angels to look forward to.
That will be the salve for the burn. Yes.
Yeah. Boy, I love those first two Charlie's Angels movies were fantastic. You know,
wasn't as nuts about the second one.
A lot
didn't
of people didn't
it.
Like the second one. I liked the second one a whole bunch. You know, I thought it really was Charlie's Angels full throttle, you know. But
I thought it was good, but the first one just had I just enjoyed the first one so much more. Although I do think that the joke in the second one of having Bernie Mac be Bill Murray's brother was great. I thought that was wonderful. That, you know, that was, and Bernie Mac was wonderful too. But yeah, it wasn't as nuts about the second one.
Yeah. No, I mean that joke totally works. But yeah, I mean the first one totally holds up. I mean, you watch that, you know, it's fantastic. But regardless, that doesn't really have anything to do with
people
like us, aside from, you know, hey, it's a good movie. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. On the whole, you know, overall, final thoughts on People Like Us?
I definitely think it's worth watching. I think I wound up giving it, I think it was like 3 out of 5, which is a good score. I mean, you know, it's worth seeing. And I think that the performances, and I think that the main plot is enough to go. And, you know, I mean, it's available for rent on, all of the services and everything. So it's worth a couple of bucks. It's worth watching.
Yeah. I think I had pretty much the same reaction. I was not blown away by it or anything, but I did think it was really solid. I think that it's, you know, interesting to get an idea of Kurtzman's talent as a director, which is, you know, substantial. And, I think it's worth checking out as well. Great performances by, you know, Chris Pine and Elizabeth Banks and all the rest of it. And, you know, some great stuff from the technical end of things, just a few stray subplots, which maybe could have been altered a bit.
Yeah.
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 All right. Well, it's been fun talking about people like us this week, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Sugar and spice and everything nice, yes, we know. But that's never mentioned in the episode at all. Like, you think there'd be some tag scene with everybody on the bridge and Kirk saying that to himself and Spock says, "Spice, Captain," or something like that, right?
I guess so.
Earl Grey.
And then as kind of a teenager, I kind of drifted a bit from Star Trek. And, you know, I pretended one time when I went to see Star Trek Nemesis that I was actually off to see Elf instead because that sounded cooler than seeing Star Trek Nemesis. And maybe it still is.
To the journey!
See, now I'm picturing, like, old Seven of Nine at the end of Titanic. You know, she's got the doctor's medical tricorder in her hand, and she lovingly tosses it over the
beautiful
side of the ship at the end of the episode.
Oh, no, she has the mobile emitter.
She takes the doctor's mobile emitter and throws it overboard.
Perfect. I love this.
The 602 Club.
I thought it was a great story about, you know, perseverance and the courage to act, even when you don't know how the outcome's going to come.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. We'd like to thank our associate producers, Norman C. Lau, Chris Steftenagel, and Jeff Sutter today.
Thank you.
If you want to be like Norm, Chris, and Jeff, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. If you go over to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to help us out, head on over to iTunes and leave us a review, and you'll be entered into a contest, which is being sponsored by our associate producer, Jeff Sutter, who has been gracious enough to donate a couple of items from his personal Star Trek collection, including a technical manual and a set of blueprints from the 70s. And if you head on over there, leave us a review. We'll read your review on the air and enter you into the contest for these prizes. And you have another couple weeks to enter. So
get your reviews in.
You have until Monday, January 16th. So this Monday. So hurry up, get your reviews in. All right. If you want to contact us, head on over to Twitter at Trek FM, or on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and we'll come right up. And that is where we talk about things with our listeners. So check that out. All right, John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for Kessel Junkie. I'm out there. And you can also find me on Words with Nerds, co-hosting with my pal Craig. You can find me over on the Nerd Party Network, co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matt Rushing, and also co-hosting a little show called Great Shot Kid about Star Wars creators with the inimitable Mike Schindler.
Yeah, you can find me over there doing that, and you can also find me on commentarytrackstars.com, where we do audio commentaries for movies and other various things. We did a commentary for Mad Max Fury Road recently, but you can find lots and lots of audio commentaries on there. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K.